This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. In his new book, Fiasco, The American Military Adventure in Iraq, my guest Thomas Ricks writes, quote, "The U.S.-led invasion was launched recklessly, with a flawed plan for war and a worse approach to occupation. Spooked by its own false conclusions about the threat, the Bush administration hurried its diplomacy, short-circuited its war planning, and assembled an agonizingly incompetent occupation." Unquote. Ricks's book examines how false conclusions were used to lead us into war and how the occupation was mishandled. The book is based on several hundred interviews, his own coverage of events in Washington, D.C. and Iraq, and a vast number of documents. Ricks is the senior Pentagon correspondent for The Washington Post. He was a member of two teams that won Pulitzer Prizes for national reporting. Tom Ricks, welcome back to Fresh Air. You write in your new book, Fiasco, that one of the reasons for all the problems we faced in Iraq is that we used intellectual acrobatics by simultaneously worst-casing the threat presented by Iraq while best-casing the subsequent cost and difficulty of occupying the country. What do you think have been the consequences of that?
I think we went into Iraq with an unrealistic idea of the difficulty of occupying the place without due consideration of what the military task might be, without integration of the military operation and the civilian operation. We basically were kind of reckless in how this country conducted the first ever occupation of an Arab nation by U.S. forces.
Was this bad accounting, the fact that we overestimated how easy it was going to be and underestimated what the cost was? Was this bad accounting or was this deceitful?
I don't know. That kind of goes to intent, and I really have not been able to get inside the mind of either Vice President Cheney or President Bush. But it does indicate to me that it wasn't simply pessimism. The Bush administration can't say, oh, we were just really grim in our outlook about the Middle East. No, they were very grim about the threat presented by Saddam Hussein's supposed weapons, but very cheerful and optimistic about the ease of being in Iraq once we were there. And that really, I think, is the result of an awareness that this was not going to be a popular war, that there wasn't going to be a lot of support. And so they really had to pull it off very quickly. And they treated it almost like a political campaign. Play up the threat, downplay the difficulty, get it through Congress, ram it past them, and make it a fait accompli. And once you've done it, it really didn't matter that there weren't weapons of mass destruction, because guess what? You're there.
One more thing about how we got into Iraq before we get to the reconstruction. You write that the National Intelligence Estimate of October 2002 succeeded brilliantly as a political document, but as a professional intelligence product, it was shameful. But you say it did its job, which wasn't really to assess Iraq weapons programs, but to sell a war. What finally was most misleading about that report?
Fundamentally, it was a public relations document rather than a sober, careful summary of the best thinking in the intelligence community about the situation with Iraq. And it kind of stuns me even now that this was accepted, because a year or two earlier, you had people like Colin Powell saying publicly, now they don't have weapons of mass destruction, they're not a threat, Saddam Hussein is contained. And without any additional evidence emerging, the U.S. government characterization of all that changed radically. Suddenly we heard talk of mushroom clouds, of threats on the horizon, about the need for preemption, and with no new facts, but simply a change in the rhetorical approach to Iraq.
Was the intelligence community misled? Did it have bad information? Was it doing a favor for the president?
You had a process, I think, where the top of the intelligence community, George Tenet, really, I think, didn't do well, where he didn't seek out the best thinking, and where dissents were either neglected or suppressed or ignored or minimized. So all the bias as the information moved upward was in one direction. It wasn't like all the doubts were eliminated. It was just all the doubts on one side of the argument were eliminated. And so all the evidence that said, yes, he has WMD moved upwards. All the people saying no were suddenly not heard from. And so the National Intelligence Estimate that was presented in the fall of 2002 fundamentally did not accurately reflect what we had spent billions of dollars trying to gather the data and information about Iraq.
Are you saying that it was Tenet who was responsible for headlining the bad news and burying, you know, for headlining, oh, bad news, they have weapons of mass destruction, and burying the fact that we don't really know that?
Yes, I am. The moment in the book that really captured it for me was when General Anthony Zinnia, recently retired Marine, was sitting behind Dick Cheney at the VFW convention in Nashville in August 2002. And Cheney got up and gave the speech that I really think of as the declaration of war in Iraq. He said, there is no doubt that Iraq has weapons of mass destruction. General Zinni was sitting behind Cheney on the stage because he was there to receive his own award from the Veterans of Foreign Wars. And he looked at Cheney and thought, my God, I still have all my clearances. I know all the intelligence. I'm out at CIA all the time. And there's no evidence to back up that statement he just made. And then the second thought General Zinni had, and remember, he had been the commander of Central Command, the U.S. headquarters for operations in the Middle East. The second thought that Zinni had was, my God, these guys are going to war with Iraq.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Tom Ricks, senior Pentagon correspondent for The Washington Post. He's a Pulitzer Prize winner and author of the new book, Fiasco, which is about the U.S. invasion, occupation, and reconstruction attempts in Iraq. Since there wasn't really a reconstruction plan for Iraq or an occupation plan, you write that the military was in the position of having to come up with plans virtually overnight. Can you give us an example of that?
The problem going into Iraq was twofold in the lack of a plan. One is, how do you conduct a military occupation? The second is things like, how do you run this country? And in neither case was there anything really ready. Colonel Alan King is quoted in my book as being told, you have 24 hours to come up with a plan for what this division, the 3rd Infantry Division, is doing here in the occupation. He'd been asking for months for a plan and been told, don't worry, you'll have it when you need it. The effect of this was that we sent in troops who had not been trained, equipped, or mentally prepared for what they had to do. And it's quite tragic, and my heart goes out to troops who are put in this impossible situation, 19, 20, 21-year-old American troops who are told, you now need to occupy this huge Arab country where you don't know the language, we don't have enough interpreters for you, and we don't have enough troops. And you have tragic situations occurring, for example, where some troops in the 1st Armored Division were told to stop looting, and they decided that the best way to deter looters was to make them cry. And so at one point, the soldiers have a father and his 2 teenage sons, and they tell the father, we're going to shoot one of your sons. Which one is it going to be? And the father said, as most fathers would, no, shoot me instead. But they took one of the sons around to the other side of the truck and then conducted a mock execution, firing a weapon next to his head, and then let them go because they had cried. That's a bad situation to put soldiers in. They improvised. Their answers weren't good. But I don't blame the soldiers for that, even though what they did was wrong. I blame the leaders who put them in that situation.
Now, you say that by describing ourselves as liberators instead of occupiers, the military planned the wrong strategy in some ways. What's the difference between a liberation strategy and an occupation strategy?
Well, liberation does a couple of things. First, it kind of sends the message, we're not going to run this place. We're going to come in, free you, and leave. It's kind of like we'll just open up the jail doors and leave. The second thing, though, is if you think of yourself as a liberator, then anybody who opposes you must be bad, must be someone who is against liberation. And there was a real confusion on the ground among troops about who the enemy was. I have a story in the book about the 4th Infantry Division and leaders in that unit saying, these people are terrorists and they will be treated as such. They began to think of anybody opposing them as terrorists. Troops weren't sure whether the Geneva Convention applied, because if you're fighting terrorists, they have been told by their leaders, the civilian leadership, that the Geneva Convention is no longer applied. Well, what rules did apply in handling Iraqis? Troops looked around and they saw CIA officers and their local Iraqi hires beating people and torturing them. And they thought, well, those guys are the professionals. That must be how you do it.
And you're right that there are certain things that you can do as an occupying force that could help keep control and keep order that you wouldn't do as liberators, like curfews. What else?
Well, you essentially are responsible as an occupier for enforcing the rule of law, and you take over the mechanism of the country. One area where this really became very damaging for us was the lack of an Iraqi prison system. It became evident in the late summer of 2003 that there really was no working Iraqi prison system, and so if you were going to detain Iraqis, that the American military would have to do it, that nothing was being stood up by the civilian authority called the CPA, and so the military said, okay, we'll do it. But they weren't prepared, they weren't trained, and they didn't have enough people to do it, and you wind up with a situation like Abu Ghraib prison, where undertrained, demoralized reservist troops felt overwhelmed by the situation, really didn't know what they were doing, deferred to a couple of sadistic soldiers who in civilian life were prison guards, and created an enormous strategic setback for the United States globally.
Now, you're right, because we underestimated the task at hand, something you've already talked about, that because we underestimated the task at hand, we didn't send a well-trained, coherent team of professionals to Iraq. Who did we send?
Well, the people who went out initially for the Coalition Provisional Authority tended to be young Republicans, people who had worked in campaigns, who really didn't have a lot of credentials except loyalty to the Republican Party. And they kind of had a very ideological approach, which is, we're not just going to come to this country and get rid of Saddam Hussein. We're going to give them a free market. We're going to have a flat tax even. We're going to do things like shut down inefficient government-owned factories and let the thousand flowers of the free market bloom. It really was quite a radical approach. One of the thoughts that occurred to me as I was writing the book was that George Bush and his team had much more in common with Jerry Rubin, the 1960s radical, than they had with Winston Churchill, the classic conservative icon. They really were going to kind of groove on the rubble, as Jerry Rubin used to say. They were going to tear it down and see what happened. And that's kind of what they were doing in Iraq, which is kind of making it up as you're going along.
So what problems do you think this caused?
Well, with this radical approach they brought in, which is let's just tear down Saddam's system and let a new system emerge, the first two steps that Ambassador Bremer took when he went into Iraq, I think, went a long way toward fueling the insurgency. The first step was the de-bathification order, which basically said anybody who'd been a fairly seasoned member of the Ba'athist Party no longer had a place in Iraqi society across the board. And it's striking that when the CIA station chief in Baghdad was showing that order in a draft form, he looked at it and he told Bremer, you can sign this, but if you do, you'll have 50,000 people driven underground by tonight, and 6 months from now you're going to regret it. Now, that's not some CIA guy second-guessing later on. That's a guy predicting accurately at the moment on a policy issue. The second thing is, not long after that, Ambassador Bremer dissolved the Iraqi military, and with it, the Minister of Interior Police. Those two steps, de-bathification and dissolution of the military, put out on the street tens of thousands of disaffected Iraqis who were leaders, many of them, and also had access to financing. And so between those policy changes and U.S. military tactics, the three basic problems of any insurgency were solved. And any insurgency, as it's emerging, has to deal with recruiting, financing, and arming itself. And between our policies and tactics, we've basically solved all three problems.
Now, you know, you were talking about how we inadvertently fueled the insurgency by helping them inadvertently with arming, financing, and recruiting by disbanding the Iraqi military. Another problem that you talk about in terms of dealing with the insurgency is that the insurgents became more and more seasoned, but new troops were constantly being rotated into Iraq. So you had insurgents that were more and more unseasoned facing new soldiers who weren't seasoned at all.
It's one of the odd lessons of Vietnam. The U.S. military came out of Vietnam and said, you know, we had this individual replacement system where soldiers came in individually into units and then left after 1 year. So there was constant turnover in units and a lot of turmoil and people feeling alienated and not having cohesion with their comrades. So they said, we know what we'll do. No longer individual rotation. Now we'll have unit rotation. But that has its own very negative effects. So you have units come in. They spend a year in Iraq, and then they leave. So they're a very cohesive unit. They all know each other. There's a sense of comradeship. But what happens when you take one unit out and put a new one in is you're back to almost zero in understanding Iraq and dealing with the locals. And Iraq is an intensely relational society. It doesn't matter what your job title is there. It matters whether somebody knows you. So if the Iraqi sheikh knows the young lieutenant, he'll deal with him rather than deal with the older commander, the guy who's really in charge, the colonel. And so you put people in for a year, and then they leave. And you lose all that accumulated knowledge. And we've been doing this now for several years in Iraq. I'm not sure it's possible to win with a rotational military and a relational society.
Is that another example of how we didn't prepare for an occupation? If we had been prepared for an occupation, would we not have had people rotating in and out like that?
I think it's an example more of a U.S. military establishment that really isn't fully mobilized for victory in Iraq, that is not thinking innovatively and originally about how to win in Iraq. I sometimes worry that the U.S. Army would rather preserve its personnel system than win in Iraq. I think winning in Iraq is not only still possible, I think it's hugely important. But I think in order to win Iraq, you'd have to change the approach. You'd have to change how we train our troops, how we think about it, how we conceive of the operation. One commander in Iraq complained to me that we have a force in Iraq that would rather protect itself than protect Iraqis. You still have a force that largely sees Iraqis as the playing field in this war rather than the prize. The best thing to do with an insurgent is not to kill him. The best thing is to make him irrelevant. Maybe get him to desert, maybe put down the gun and go into politics. But basically, the fight is about the people. It's not about the enemy. And that's a real huge shift for the U.S. military. And I think there have been changes in the military, but the military establishment as a whole, I think, really has not thought seriously about how much it would need to change in order to win there. One example would be, you might say, you know, there is a problem here about relationships. We do need to maintain them. So what we can do is keep all brigade and division commanders, that is to say senior commanders and their staff, in Iraq for 2 or 3 years. Now, people would say, well, that would break up their families, that would abuse them, that would result in divorces. I could design a system, anybody could who knows the military, where maybe you put people in for 2 months and then have them come out for 1 month, which is what a lot of reporters do in Iraq, a two-month-in, one-month-out policy. You can give them extra staff. You can give them senior executive officers who can run the unit when they're not there. And you can make it worth their while. You could say, when you finish here, Colonel, you will automatically get a one-grade promotion to Brigadier General, and so on. You could say, when you come out of here, you will automatically get any military education that you missed, like going to the Army War College. You will go to the front of the line. You'd have to be innovative. You'd have to really depart from the kind of the industrial era model of military personnel management. But I think it would be worth thinking about, because I think it could lead to victory in Iraq.
You're right. While the nation was at war and American soldiers were dying, the Pentagon's top civilians were estranged from the Army's leadership. What were the disagreements between the Pentagon and the Army during the occupation?
Well, the background was a kind of running feud almost between Donald Rumsfeld and the Army's leadership, especially General Eric Shinseki. And it's a bad situation to go into a war with, in which there simply is a fundamental misunderstanding between the Army, the most important service in this war, and the civilians leading it. To the point with immediately after the invasion, Rumsfeld fired Tommy White, the Secretary of the Army. A couple of months later, General Shinseki stepped down in a very bitter retirement ceremony to which he would not invite Rumsfeld or Wolfowitz. Then they're on the ground in Iraq, and again, commanders would say they needed more troops. And the word came back again and again, you're not going to get them. So, for example, early on, the top U.S. military headquarters in Iraq did what they call a troops-to-task analysis, in which they looked at the missions they'd been given and then looked at how many troops it would take to do that. And they came to the conclusion that they needed about twice as many troops as they had on hand. So there was kind of resentment that people at the top weren't listening to them, weren't paying attention, and were simply making decisions based on beliefs in Washington rather than on the realities of the ground in Iraq.
You describe a kind of inconsistent sense of leadership in Iraq that, you know, for example, you write that Jay Garner, when he was the head of the Coalition Provisional Authority, wanted to retrain the Iraqi military to do low-tech reconstruction work. But then the CPA under Bremer's leadership ended up disbanding the Iraqi army. So did the members of the Iraqi army consider this a broken promise?
Very much. And it wasn't just that Jay Garner had said, we're going to hold on to the Iraqi military for reconstruction. These soldiers in the Iraqi army had been leafleted for years by American airplanes dropping leaflets over Iraq during the no-fly zone and especially during the run-up to the war. And they'd been told, go home, don't fight us, we'll take care of you. And then when the Americans showed up, it was kind of like Charlie Brown, you know, had the football pulled away. And they said, no, you people have no role in the society, get lost. That occurred in the context also of the looting, which I think many Iraqis were shaken by when they saw this widespread looting and Donald Rumsfeld saying, well, stuff happens, freedom could be untidy. It sent the message that either the Americans couldn't stop the looting, which meant they really weren't competent, or wouldn't stop the looting, which meant that the Americans may not have the best interest of the average Iraqi at heart. You know, I'm not saying that's true. I'm saying that's how Iraqis interpreted that. So to have that looting occur, the sense that, boy, these people aren't taking responsibility, and then have this sense of a broken promise that many Iraqi military men felt, those drove people, I think, towards the insurgency.
So how does something so inconsistent as this happen? Did Paul Bremer not know that the Iraqis had been leafleted and that the Iraqi military was promised that we would take care of them?
Well, it's kind of the opposite of what John F. Kennedy said. Didn't he say that success has 1,000 fathers, failure is an orphan? I think in this sense, actually, failure had 1,000 fathers. I think there wasn't one root cause. It was again and again, though, decisions made with a kind of careless attitude, a certain recklessness in the approach, and a kind of ideological approach, which is, let's not talk about plan B because plan A is going to work and we're certain it's going to work. Well, you should always have a plan B handy in case, despite your assumptions, plan A doesn't work. But here, having any sort of alternative approach and saying, you know, that might not be the way Iraqis see it, was kind of seen as disloyal. And I think that goes to one of the themes of the Bush administration that I perceive, which is dissent, honest dissent, is seen as disloyalty. And you see this in the prosecution of the war generally. Most times when you fight a war, you want to have a bipartisan basis. Here, people like Representative Ike Skelton, who I write about in the book, a conservative Democrat, when he brings up criticisms of the Bush administration, really gets the back of the hand from the administration. His letters to the president are ignored. When he tells a White House official that he has some real concerns about going to war, rather than have those concerns addressed, the official said to him, well, Congressman, we don't need your vote. So you have this very narrow approach to the handling of the war. The other thing that I think really caused a lot of these problems is what I think of as the dog that didn't bark in all this. Most of the problems in the war are sins of commission, whether it's the Bush administration, a military establishment, the intelligence community, or the media screwing up in its stories. But the Congress is the fifth big problem, and I think in many ways the biggest. The Congress wasn't carrying through its responsibility to conduct oversight. And so it wasn't quizzing the administration about what was going on in Iraq. It wasn't getting solid information. It wasn't demanding that it get the facts. Even now, it's very difficult to separate out Iraq from Afghanistan because the Pentagon releases data that combines the two, the cost of the operations and so on. Had you had the Congress more active, conducting oversight, saying, Mr. Rumsfeld, we need to have this information, or we want you to send your division commanders from Iraq to testify in front of us, I think that would have given the entire operation more rigor. It would have given it the oxygen of information, and it would have addressed some of these longstanding contradictions. The friction, for example, that was created by having this hazy chain of command. Nobody was in charge in Iraq. Bremer was in charge of the civilians. General Sanchez and then General Casey were in charge of the military, but neither reported to each other. Both reported to people on the other side of the planet, 7,000 miles away. And because of this, it's a violation, by the way, of classic doctrine, which is you must have unity of command. You must have one person in charge. Instead, you constantly in Iraq had the civilian effort and the military effort at odds.
And you're right that over time, the CPA, the Coalition Provisional Authority, and the military acted less like partners and more like adversaries.
Yeah, one general said to me he considered the CPA the biggest asset the enemy had. It's quite a bitter assessment. But it was very odd in Iraq during the CPA's time, that first year of the occupation from the summer of 03 to the summer of 04. I'd be out in some base in Bakuba or in northern Iraq, and it's dusty and it's hard and it's 120 degrees and the wind blows and you constantly feel gravel and gritty. And really the biggest treat you could have in life was having a shower and then going to sleep. And then you go down to Baghdad and go inside the Green Zone, and it was party time. People were living in these old Saddam palaces. There were, I think, 7 bars in the Green Zone. You couldn't get alcohol in the U.S. military and the rest of the country. There was disco night. They were showing movies. It really felt like another planet. I used to think occasionally, if you remember your Superman comics, the bottled city of Kandor, which Superman kept in his cave up in the Arctic. And I kind of feel in the Green Zone like I was in the bottled city of Kandor. It didn't feel right to me. I didn't like being in the Green Zone, and I'd get out of it generally as fast as I could. It's a myth, by the way, that reporters live in the Green Zone. Last I looked, there may be 2 or 3 there, but most reporters actually live out in what the military calls the Red Zone, which is the rest of Iraq.
Getting back to the difference in goals between what the military wanted to accomplish in Iraq and what the CPA wanted to accomplish, I mean, it was the military's job to keep the population quiet and to try to keep things under control, to get some structure. And you're saying that the CPA was trying to, like, radically change things, which would stir things up as opposed to keeping things quiet and controlled.
Exactly. And to see this in towns, I'd go into some town and I'd be talking to the local American commander. And the ones who were successful, I'd say, well, who's the mayor? Oh, he's a former Army general. Oh, he's an old Baathist, but he's an okay guy. They basically found the apparatchiks of the old system and would quietly install them and kind of hide them sometimes from CPA. And they were really in some ways out to subvert CPA policies. And they'd cut deals that kind of ignored directives coming down from the CPA. Up in Mosul, for example, the 101st Division under General Petraeus actually got official dispensation to ignore some of the debathification, partly because the city was relatively quiet and they wanted to keep it that way. Unfortunately, the 101st left, and then the new unit came in. As we were talking about rotation policies earlier, it was a smaller unit, and it lost touch with the leaders in Mosul, and pretty soon Mosul erupted.
How did the Bush administration decide to end the CPA?
Well, the CPA kind of never really got off the ground. It reminded me of those old newsreels of U.S. rocket launches in the late 50s where they kind of go up 15 feet and then go sideways. The CPA died a slow death. It first had its ambitions curtailed in the fall of 2003, and then it was announced, no, the occupation is not going to last for years. In fact, we're going to try to toss the ball of sovereignty to an interim Iraqi government by June of 04, which is what they did. And Paul Bremer had a very quick, quiet announcement, scooted out to the airport, hopped on one plane, and then as soon as the observers left, hopped on another plane and got out of Iraq.
Private military contractors have played a very large role in Iraq. Where has it worked best and where has it worked worst?
The use of private military contractors, which is really basically a polite term for mercenaries, has worked best when it's closest to kind of a security role, a policing role. And I have no objection, I think probably nobody does, to using people as bodyguards, civilians as bodyguards for Paul Bremer or even for senior generals or for Iraqi officials who need protection. Where it's most worrisome is when you have military-style units that are not subject to military discipline or the military chain of command and may not even be covered by any rule of law. And you get them out in the streets of Baghdad, and they are a law unto themselves. They are the law of the gun. And their job is simply to protect some guy. They don't care about the strategic goals of the United States. They don't care about making the Iraqi population feel comfortable with the American presence. Their job is to keep someone alive. So they drive up on the sidewalks. They point their weapons at anybody who comes close to them. And they're doing their mission, which is to keep some high authority, some leader alive. But in the process, they're undercutting the larger purpose of the Americans being there. and I think that gets very dangerous. The lack of discipline is especially worrisome when you get alcohol or drugs involved. And U.S. troops, while they occasionally sneak some alcohol, generally don't. And the private contractors are not subject to those rules, and that's very dangerous. The other thing that worries me is when they come home. The U.S. military has a very good mental health care system that watches people, that pays attention to people who have had problems, and acts on them and gets them counseling. You take a private military contractor who's been through some very difficult, violent times in Iraq, who maybe abused alcohol to get him through the post-traumatic stress disorder while he was there, and then he comes home and he's on his own. And I worry about just letting those people out in society and worry about their own personal safety as they try to deal with these problems totally alone and isolated.
You have written about disagreements within the civilian and military leadership in Iraq and how there wasn't a clear chain of command. Are there disagreements now between the military in Iraq and the Pentagon?
Where I really see the divide these days is inside the military itself. There's a lot of pessimism about Iraq at this point inside the military, especially among senior officers, the majors, lieutenant colonels, colonels, and brigadier generals. And the divide I see is between the people who say, we have just messed this up too much, this can't work, and another group that says, no, we can do it, we just have to tough it out. And maybe even a third group that says we can still win, but we'd have to be radically different. So I think there's three very different approaches there. And you see this also in the troops in Iraq. One commander, when I was there earlier this year, said that one-third of his commanders understood the need to operate differently and conduct counterinsurgency operations, which is very counterintuitive for most U.S. commanders. Everything they've been taught in their whole life as commanders is really turned upside down when you're doing a counterinsurgency. You don't want to use maximum firepower, which is what you've been taught all your life. You want to use the minimal amount of firepower necessary to get the job done. You treat your prisoners well, because today's prisoner might be the mayor tomorrow if you're able to bring him into the political system. You really operate and think very differently. One-third of his commanders, he said, got that. Another third kind of understood it intellectually but didn't have the ability to implement it. And then he said the last third doesn't care, doesn't want to know, and is simply here to kick it a little ass. And he said those guys are just undercutting the operation.
Give us a sense of what you think the possible outcomes are now in Iraq.
I'm pretty pessimistic, but I still think there's a chance. I think there's a 5% chance that we'll wind up with a stable, pro-American democracy. But I think it's a pretty small chance. I think it's more likely that we'll simply stay there for another 15 or 20 years, kind of keeping a lid on a low-level civil war, trying to prevent it from spreading over the borders. And that's not unlike the French in Algeria or the Israelis in Lebanon. Ultimately, they didn't prevail. But in some ways, a defeat deferred is a form of victory. Neither the loss of Algeria for the French or the end of the Lebanese occupation for the Israelis threatened the national survival of the country. But a worse scenario would be the war in Iraq spreading. And this is, I think, a real worrisome possibility. And that could lead to spiraling oil prices and global economic depression and terrorist acts. And I think that's a real problem that we need to all pay attention to. That's not the nightmare scenario. I think the worst case scenario would be after years of bloodshed and chaos, the Iraqi people get fed up and kind of turn to a new strongman who's probably anti-American, maybe a former military officer, who unites the country under a kind of a pan-Arab Iraqi banner, maybe Islamic extremist, maybe some mix of nationalism and religious extremism, and takes the oil that country has, takes the water that country has, the people it has, the only Arab country that has all three, and unites them and harnesses them and creates a new, really anti-Western power, takes that oil money and goes out and buys himself a nuclear weapon and starts attacking the West. And I think that would be a real nightmare for us as well.
But you think that's a real possibility too?
Yeah, I'd say it's out there at the far end of the spectrum as a possibility, but there is a precedent for it. It's not unlike what happened during the Crusades, when crusaders out of Western Europe attacked a fractured Arab world and were quite successful at first until a new Arab leader emerged. His name was Saladin. He was an Iraqi Kurd from, of all places, Tikrit, Iraq, hometown of Saddam Hussein. He united the Arab world and ousted the crusaders from most of the Middle East. So there is a precedent there.
You've been writing about the military for a long time. You have a lot of close contacts in the military. A lot of soldiers and former soldiers are, I think it's fair to say, your friends because you've communicated with them for so long. Is the result that you found in the book, are the results that you found in your book about the invasion and occupation of Iraq different from what you were expecting to find when you started?
Yes, it was very different and in many ways dismaying to me. As you say, a lot of these people are my friends. I've known these guys. I like and admire people in the military. I spent a lot of time around them. I enjoy them. And as I did my research and as I read these tens of thousands of pages of documents, patterns began to emerge that were very disturbing to me. It was a little bit like having a photograph develop in front of your eyes, one of those old Polaroids or something, and you expect it'll be a photograph of your daughter's birthday party or something, and instead, as the photograph develops, you see an axe murderer standing in the background. One of the things that really stunned me, and it was a hard chapter to write, was the extent of abuse by U.S. troops in Iraq. I had gone into writing the book thinking that Abu Ghraib was a relatively small, unimportant part of the Iraq story. And the more I read documents, the more interviews I did, and the more I talked to commanders about what went wrong out there, the more I realized, no, this was a major problem and really helped turn a big chunk of the Iraqi population against us, that Abu Ghraib was a misnomer. It wasn't just a few troops in one place. It happened repeatedly in different units across the country. It was not just some military police reservist. It was the 4th Infantry Division. It was the 3rd Armored Cavalry Regiment. It was the 2nd Armored Cavalry Regiment. I'm not saying it was universal in each of those units, but in some units there was an atmosphere that allowed a lot of abuse to happen and the commanders sometimes looked the other way when they were notified about it. So that was a really unhappy surprise for me and actually made writing that part of the book on the descent into abuse quite difficult.
And do you think that the extent of that abuse was because it was policy or because there was a lack of leadership saying you can't do that?
I think that very much it was a lack of leadership and a lack of preparation. But even if the troops were unprepared, if commanders were aware and sensitive to the issue and realized that it was a militarily ineffective approach to allow abuse, it could get shut down pretty quickly. One of the heroes in my book is Major General David Petraeus, who commanded the 101st Airborne Division up in Mosul in northern Iraq. And the first time that Petraeus heard about abuse in his division, he basically stopped the division. He put it on hold and said not only what happened there and who did wrong, he looked at himself in the mirror and said, what are we doing wrong? What has my approach been wrong here about? Now, Petraeus is striking because he's a very well-educated man. He has a PhD from Princeton in international relations, and he studied the Vietnam War as part of his PhD dissertation. He knew that was not the right approach. So when he heard about abuse in his division, he addressed the issue, he changed his procedures, and made sure it didn't happen again. He even went so far as to go to Iraqi leaders, clerics, professors, political leaders, and ask them to visit his detention facility once a week to talk to detainees and make sure that they felt they were treated all right. The effect of this was that abuse in his division stopped. Even after they lost about 35 guys in 1 month, they were able to maintain the leadership. And when I asked him about this, he said, it's the general who sets the tone for the division. Another example I saw of this was the 3rd Armored Cavalry Regiment, which I mentioned on its first tour in Iraq was quite mediocre and had a lot of instances of abuse and hitting Iraqis with baseball bats, and one prisoner was beaten to death. In its second tour, it was led by a man named H.R. McMaster, a colonel. And McMaster retrained that unit. He went to every soldier in that unit and spoke to them in groups. And he told them, every time you disrespect an Iraqi, you're working for the enemy. It was a great phrase to use. It was said in a way that soldiers could understand. An 18-year-old, 19-year-old American soldiers could say, okay, I get that. We want to win here, so let's not disrespect Iraqis. And they could remind each other, which is part of discipline is everybody taking responsibility for the unit. McMaster did brilliant things also, like setting up a program they called Ask the Customer. When detainees were released, they were asked, how were you treated? And the soldiers knew they'd be asked. And it was a way of saying, we will abide by the rule of law. We do carry out in our acts as well as our words this intention to treat Iraqis differently and to show how a military acts decently. The other thing that McMaster did that I was quite struck by when I was up there earlier this year in Tal Afar, northwest Iraq, looking at his operation, is he went to local insurgent leaders. And he said, when the Americans first came to Iraq, we were like blind men stumbling around the room. But now there's a new Iraqi government, and it's turned on the lights. And the time for honorable resistance is over. It's the most brilliant way I've ever heard of threatening to kill someone. It's an apology saying, you know, we're sorry for our behavior here. But he's also saying, you have to stop now. I know who you are. I know what you're doing. And the time for honorable resistance is over. It's such a way of respecting Iraqi at the same time that you threaten to kill him. I think it was very effective.
Do you think that the American military has changed its methods of operation sufficiently in Iraq to be able to say we've learned from the mistakes and things are different now?
Parts of the military have learned from the mistakes, and I think people going back for a second tour are trying to do it very differently. I was struck talking to soldiers early this year who are on their second tour, how different it felt to them and how they're being told to operate. But as I said, this rule of one-third gets it, one-third is trying and one-third doesn't care, indicates to me that two-thirds of our units there are probably still pretty ineffective. So while there are changes, I think it could be too little too late.
Do your sources include a lot of people in the military who have been unhappy at how the Bush administration or the leadership of the military has handled the war?
Yes, I was really struck by the extent of unhappiness. I knew that there were a lot of officers unhappy with Donald Rumsfeld and Paul Wolfowitz. I hadn't quite appreciated the rage that some officers felt, the real sense of betrayal that they felt and how this thing has been handled. The sense they had that soldiers have died unnecessarily under their command and that they will carry that with them the rest of their lives. Yeah, so there are people who are really upset. But there's also a sense that if we can get out an accurate account of what's happened here, if we can do away with this rosy scenario look at Iraq and honestly and soberly and coldly assess our operations, we could still win out there. But there's a sense, I think, inside the Army that the Army hasn't really undergone a thorough self-examination that critically judges what they do. For example, this is the first war I can think of in which no generals have been relieved. Contrast that to General George Marshall at the outset of World War II, relieved 250 officers, told them they were good men, but they were simply not what he needed. Dozens of generals were removed during World War II. This is the first war I can think of also in which the Congress has not held a single significant hearing on the conduct of the war. In the Civil War, the Congress was intrusive, antagonized Lincoln. It looked into the war so much. World War II, Harry Truman made his name by conducting hearings on defense contracting. This Congress, as I say in the book, is basically silent. In other wars, you had hawks and doves. In this war, you have the silence of the lambs.
Tom Ricks, thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Tom Ricks is the Washington Post's senior Pentagon correspondent. His new book is called Fiasco, The American Military Adventure in Iraq.